I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Professor Sarah Benor of Hebrew Union College, discussing the sociology of Jewish camps, the Pew Report, and Neo-Orthodox Jews. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mavena on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I've been back from my sabbatical trip around the world to the holiest places on earth for, about 2 months now, and I think it's time to do some evaluation of just what was learned on that epic journey. And you lucky listeners are the recipients of my desire to unpack that experience and share it with the world, or at least the best part of the world, which is, of course, our loyal Two Jewish audience. A few observations to begin what will be a several-week-long discussion. The first is that when I decided I would try to see all the holiest places in the world over the course of a 3-month-long sabbatical trip, the proper response seemed to be, "That's impossible," although a better one might have been, "You are nuts." It's one thing to go and visit the holiest places in one country or even on one continent, but to attempt to see all the most sacred sites on the globe in less than 90 days, as it turned out it was actually around the world in 85 days, bordered on the preposterous. But I was determined to take this opportunity and seize it to see what made these places so different from the many holy places our species has chosen and sanctified over the millennia of our existence. So, after visiting 20 countries and over 125 of the holiest sites on the globe, I'm beginning to draw a few conclusions both about the experience itself and what it is that makes a place sacred. The first observation, the one that became completely clear over the course of this odyssey, is that people go to holy places everywhere in the world for very much the same reasons. They are drawn by the need to seek healing, or to find love, or to connect with something greater than themselves. And sometimes they go to find community with other believers. This is true whether it is Roman Catholics making pilgrimage to Lourdes or Santiago de Compostela or Rome or Nazareth, Greek Orthodox Christians traveling to Meteora or the Patriarchate in Istanbul, Jews ascending to Jerusalem or Tzfat, Muslims praying in mosques in Turkey, Egypt or India, Hindus worshiping in Varanasi or Bali or Kuala Lumpur, Buddhists meditating in Bodh Gaya or Mount Koya or Borobudur, Shintos seeking blessings in Kyoto, Sikhs in Amritsar, Baha'is in Haifa, Jains in Delhi, Druze in the Galilee, Aboriginals at Ayers Rock, Rapa Nui on Easter Island. Everyone comes seeking healing or love or connection to the divine or to a human community. The second observation is that no matter what religion you practice, there is a commonality of believers that transcends theology. We share a common feeling about human beings and our relationships to each other and to our gods or God. It is how a Balinesian Hindu and a Tibetan Buddhist monk and a Slovakian Catholic and an Egyptian Sunni Muslim and a Japanese Shinto priest and an American Jew can connect and respect each other and understand that they are all engaged in the same pursuit of holiness. We understand that our differences of language and belief are less important than our similarity of humanity and our shared respect for true religious sensibility. We may identify the divine in different ways, approach worship and music and creating sanctity from widely varying perspectives, use different languages, clothing, and rituals, but at heart, we know that we are all the same and that we need the same things from our religion and its sacred places, that what we can offer to other believers is no more nor less than our hearts and our hands. And third, every religious tradition uses some of the same natural elements and physical features in its practices. There are sacred mountains and hills in every tradition. There are holy bodies of water, too, rivers, lakes, pools, ponds. Almost every religion has sacred caves and caverns. Almost all holy sites are oriented by their position to the sun. Almost every tradition uses fire in its worship. Holiness is created by connecting us to our primal elements, physically linking us to that which is deepest within us. And finally, while the types of music I heard varied widely, even wildly, from evensong at Canterbury Cathedral to Tibetan Buddhist chants and instruments in northern India, to the call of the muezzin from the minaret in Cairo to Incan songs in Peru, the quality of the music, the care, skill, effort, and talent employed in creating a sense of the sacred through melody and rhythm was central to many of the holiest places. And the importance of religious music in releasing the spirit to soar cannot be overestimated. As an American Reformed Jew and a contemporary rabbi, many of these elements at first seem alien, strange, weird. But the more holy places I visited and the more I saw, heard, smelled, and felt the energy in these sacred sites, the more convinced I became that we are gifted with a common, essential holiness. It is the task of religions everywhere, and especially of holy places, to allow that sacred spark to combust, to bring together elements that allow us to flourish religiously, to find our innate sanctity. I'll keep rattling around these ideas, I'm sure, for some time, and continue to try to share them with you along the way. I hope they make some sense, and that all of this has meaning to you considerate listeners of Too Jewish. Play us in this morning. Here's a melody for Shabbat, the day of holiness in Jewish tradition. Livshi Bigdei Tifartechami from the Lachad Odi, the song of welcome for the Sabbath bride from Gad Elbaz. That was Livshi Bigdei Tifartechami from the Lachad Odi. When we return in a few moments here on Too Jewish, we'll meet our guest, Professor Sarah Benor, a sociologist from Hebrew Union College in Los Angeles, exploring Jewish camps, neo-Orthodox Jews, and lots more about contemporary Judaism when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquagaki Tribe.
We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish, our guests this morning. Professor Sarah Benur is an associate professor of contemporary Jewish studies at the Los Angeles campus of Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. She also teaches not only there, but also at the University of Southern California, USC. She has written Becoming From, How Newcomers Learn the Language and Culture of Orthodox Judaism, as well as a number of articles. And she continues to work in interesting and sometimes surprising areas of Jewish sociology. Good morning and welcome.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
So you have started working on a project on Jewish camps. Can you explain your approach to that?
Sure. Along with my colleagues Jonathan Krasner and Sharon Avni, I am visiting a number of camps and interviewing many people involved with camps to find out how different camps use Hebrew and how they use not only full sentences and announcements in Hebrew, but also words from Hebrew sprinkled into their English.
So it's a linguistics approach, and you come from a linguistics background into how Jewish camps sort of teach Hebrew?
Right, exactly.
Aside from people knowing that, like, the Moadon is the big hall, there's always this sort of, how can we describe this exactly, mixture of Hebrew and English that's used in camps. Is that unique to the camp setting?
Yes, I think it is unique. In Jewish life in general, there are Hebrew and Yiddish words that are used within English. In linguistics, we call it loan words. It doesn't mean that you borrow it and give it back, but it's just a technical term when a word from one language is used in another language. And that is common in Jewish life, but in camps, there is a specific set of Hebrew loanwords that are used to refer to locations and activities and roles at camp. So it's not just the normal Jewish English that you have in synagogues and schools and homes, but it's also a specialized camp Hebrew.
There's also a kind of a slang that develops, like shortening. Israelis shorten Hebrew in one way, but Americans shorten it in a different way, I think.
Exactly. So you get things that would be ungrammatical in Hebrew, like the chadar instead of the chadar ochel for dining hall. Whereas if you were just saying that word in Hebrew, you would say cheder, room.
Right.
And you get the marp, which is...
The marpea.
Exactly. And in Hebrew today, it would be mirpa'a, but one camp a long time ago said marpa'a, and it was shortened to marp, and it stuck. And camps around the country do use that term marp to refer to infirmary.
It's fascinating. We will talk much more with Professor Sarah Benur when we come back here on Too Jewish in just a few moments. We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. We started talking last week about Freedom Smoke, the smokeless product, no tobacco, to get people off of cigarettes. What are the health advantages to using your product as opposed to smoking?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. We have a lot of physicians here in town, from neurologists to ophthalmologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, sending patients to us because of damaging effects from emphysema, everything of the like that comes from smoking cancerous cigarettes.
And Freedom Smoke International provides all kinds of flavors, pleasurable experience, but not the same health risk.
That's right. You have the same experience as smoking. You have the hand-to-mouth, the mantra of the In-N-Out, as well as vapors compared to cigarette smoke. So there's no secondhand smoke either.
How can people find your product?
They can find us through freedomsmokeusa.com. Our toll-free number, which is here in Tucson, is 800-705-7013.
And then go into a store.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have three stores. We're opening a fourth in the next couple of months here in town.
We will talk more next week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Recently, there have been strange and interesting reports that Israel is engaging in direct talks with Hamas, the arch-terrorist Palestinian group in control of Gaza that is dedicated to the destruction of the Jewish state, and with whom Israel has fought wars three times in the past half decade or so. While clearly there have been some negotiations with Hamas in the past, how else could they possibly have traded Gilad Shalit for hundreds of Palestinian terrorists just a couple years ago? These negotiations have been indirect, brokered by Egypt, Germany, or others. These arrangements were very much behind the scenes. Well, now we're seeing them move closer to the surface. First, in May, Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, the Fatah top guy, complained about Israel meeting directly with Hamas in secret talks in Israel and in some unnamed European capitals at a time when Hamas was slamming Fatah regularly in the press. Abbas claimed that Israel was offering to assist Hamas in establishing a Palestinian state in the Gaza Strip, that is, leaving him out of the picture, and to cooperate on creating a Palestinian port, possibly a floating one. Clearly, there have been negotiations on the return of the bodies of some Israeli soldiers killed in last summer's Gaza war, being traded for Hamas prisoners held by Israel. But is there something more going on? In early June, journalist J.J. Goldberg, who seems to have his finger on most of what's happening in Israel and the Middle East more generally, wrote about ongoing talks between Israel and Hamas. According to Goldberg, the Israeli side aims to clarify terms for reconstruction in Gaza following last summer's war. Hamas, reports say, wants to discuss a 5 or maybe even a 10-year truce. The Israeli in charge of contacts with Hamas, Major General Yoav Pauli Mordechai, coordinator of government activities in the territories, hasn't hidden the fact that he's open to a truce. Neither has the chief of staff of the IDF, Lieutenant General Gadi Eiskanot, whose views reflect the consensus of Israel's military and intelligence community. Israel's political leadership under Bibi Netanyahu rejects the idea of a long-term accord with Hamas, but apparently has turned a blind eye to the talks going on as long as they're held at arm's length and focused on practical issues like the return of bodies. But things seem to be changing. These talks apparently gained momentum after a Grad missile was fired into Israel May 26th from northern Gaza, the first such attack since last summer's war. It landed in an open area, caused no damage, although one teen was treated for shock. That rocket was fired by a disgruntled cell of Islamic Jihad, Hamas's junior ally but radical rival. But Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Ya'alon said Israel held Hamas responsible. Israel replied with aerial attacks on 4 unmanned Gaza targets. Hamas, uncharacteristically, didn't counterattack. Instead, it arrested 4 Islamic Jihad members the next day. Since then, the IDF and Hamas have eliminated the foreign middlemen and begun exchanging messages through a Palestinian figure, according to Yedioth Ahronot's military commentator Alex Fishman. The negotiations, in effect, have become direct. While Netanyahu and the official political leadership of Israel continue to group Hamas with ISIS and ISIL as Islamist jihadis, Israeli military and intelligence leaders see a path out of the retribution morass through negotiation. Time will tell, but it's the first hopeful sign we have seen coming from the Gaza region in a very, very long time. We welcome our Mivinon Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson, Arizona. Good morning, Oshrat. Boker Tov.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Israel has absorbed as many immigrants per capita in the course of its 67 years as any country, I think, in the history of humanity. Started with, 600,000 Israelis. There's now 7.5 million Israelis, and they come from every country in the world, and a huge percentage of immigrants have come since the State of Israel was founded. So maybe we could learn in America about absorbing immigrants from Israel. Can you talk a little bit about the process, how it works for someone who wants to become, make Aliyah to Israel, whether they're coming from France now or Argentina?
Yeah, but I'll start with a very short joke. During Israel 67, you know, the
celebrations,
so people shared through media all kind of, you know, so one of the things I saw on Facebook, a list of 30 different things about, like, things that you can find in Israel, but their names are not Israeli, like Turkish coffee, this, and nothing Israeli. The only Israeli thing was Israeli chutzpah. So, like, I think it's...
Which is originally a Yiddish word, by the way, but never mind.
Yeah. So, Israel, chutzpah Israelit. So, like, so it shows that everything in Israel, most of the things in Israeli is, you know...
Came from somewhere else.
And, you know, at the end of the day, we are only 67. Like, we are very young, and for a very young country to deal with high numbers of immigrants from different places with different needs, and to be able to gap all these cultures and languages, it's a miracle. Like, by itself, it's a miracle. So, and I know that we talked about Ethiopian immigrants the last shows, and also it was, you know, we were only 30 something years old when we absorbed a very difficult and unique population from Ethiopia. That
a population that didn't have any technology. Some of them had never seen a door handle. I mean, it was very sophisticated,
really,
in some ways, but technologically they had nothing.
Not just technology, even like day to day, like the
right.
Not to use cars, nothing. Like,
yeah.
It's really, really different. So yeah, it's a huge challenge for a young country. Also, not for a young country, but for a young country even more so.
You know, it's kind of fantastic when we think about it. It's equivalent in if after World War II, America had suddenly absorbed 150 million new Americans in the course of the next 10 or 15 years. Israel doubled its population after the War of Independence was completed before the 1960s. So it's almost an incredible concept. Mm-hmm. And then it didn't stop. So I think that experience has proven not without its bumps, but by and large extremely successful. Could be an incredible lesson even for a country like America. Thanks, Oshra.
I agree. Thank you.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Welcome back from Israel a week or two ago now. We started talking about the way that Israel offers really a high level of service for people of Alzheimer's and dementia, elderly in general. And then you mentioned, I think at the end of the session last week, about Thai and Filipino guest workers who seem to be the people that staff these programs almost exclusively in Israel. That's a change for Israel. It's been coming for a while. Let's discuss that a little bit.
Right. So just to clarify, it's not so much the professional staff at the institution, whether medical or social worker, or psychiatrist, whatever.
Right.
It's the personal caregivers at home, the sort of in-home
caregivers,
full-time caregivers,
right,
who are like 99% either Thai or Filipino. And they kind of, while the people for whom they care are in these sessions at Milabev, they sit around in a lunchroom or playroom and get together and party in either Tagalog or Thai. And every once in a while, there's a Sri Lankan or something else, but overwhelmingly, and it turns out there are agencies in Israel that pay to bring these people over and then hire them out. So people are kind of slightly paying off the debt of travel incurred by an employment agency, but all these people are there, quote unquote, legally. They have work permits, residence permits, et cetera, et cetera. And it raises a couple of questions. One, in any public gathering, in a bus station or whatever, you suddenly see large numbers of people who clearly are not from a recognizably Jewish background. In fact, they're not Jewish.
Or Arab, for that matter.
Right. The Filipinos have sparked an increase in membership in Roman Catholic churches. The Thai presumably have some Buddhist clergy to go to. I have no idea, really. But the color, the picture of Israel is changing in multiple ways, because not only do you have a large number of legal residents who are personal caregivers from Thailand and the Philippines, you also have all the Jewish immigrants from Ethiopia, which presents another challenge to Israel in the sense that they are recognized as Jews, so they're subject to the law of return. They do get full citizenship. They do get resettled in a way the same way that the Yemenites were in the 50s, which is they don't get all the benefits and all the high-level housing accorded to immigrants from France or from Russia, basically because they don't look white. And there's a deep strain, apparently, in Israeli society and in Israeli politics, and particularly the politics of immigration and absorption, which somehow feels instinctively, this may be completely unconscious, that non-white people who don't look like you and me don't deserve as fair a shake when they first start out in terms of housing, professional training, whatever. They're presumed to be somehow less able or less demanding or less capable. So a lot of Ethiopians, particularly now that there are some who are actually born in Israel and native speakers of Hebrew and have no accent or anything else, feel a certain amount of frustration and discrimination. When they can, they go to their own synagogues, their own community centers. There's enough Ethiopians that many cities have facilities for people with whom other Ethiopians are comfortable.
We can talk about this more. We've been exploring Ethiopian Jewry on and off over the year, actually, with all the stuff going on. But a very interesting subject. And we can also talk about some other African immigrants next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Mr. and Mrs. Goldberg have just gotten married. On their way to the honeymoon, Goldberg says to his new wife, "Darling, would you have married me if my father hadn't left me a fortune?" And she replies, "Honey, I would have married you no matter who left you a fortune." That was the Old Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature of Two Jewish Just for You. You should live and be well. This week in the Book of Numbers, we read the odd ritualistic Torah portion of Chukat, the rites of the red heifer. In order to achieve true ritual purity, ancient Jews were required to find a completely unblemished young red female cow, slaughter it, burn it to ashes, and mix the ashes with water to create a liquid of purification in which to wash away ritual impurity. While many elements in the sacrificial code of our ancestors seem odd or alien, this one might be the strangest ritual of all. For it turns out that the red heifer, the Para Aduma, makes the one who is washed in its ash water pure, but it makes everybody else who comes into contact with it impure. The mystery of this is complete, and the commentators have struggled with its meaning ever since the time the Torah was given. Just what is it that makes the red heifer the right animal to bring purity to people? And why does it make you pure if you use it properly, but make you impure when you are properly preparing it? The classic answer to the first question is that God ordains the use of a red heifer as a symbolic reversal of the episode of the golden calf. Since the people sinned by praying to an idol of a calf, the very real slaughter and burning of an actual cow and the use of its ashes might well atone for that earlier transgression. But why should the process of making something that cleanses us ritually at the same time make the people preparing it unclean? Perhaps the answer is also symbolic. The process of bringing holiness into our world is never easy. Working in the field of holiness creation isn't simple. When you toil in the vineyards of the Lord, some of the muck that always exists in the world can attach itself to you. We seek to bring purity in the lives of others, but we stand a good chance of exchanging some of our own innate sanctity for a bit of the grime that stubbornly persists in most people's existence. The complex reversal of holiness in a sacred cow like the red heifer symbolizes the way in which we can only bring sanctity and purity at a certain price. When we acknowledge that price, accept it, and learn to cleanse ourselves ritually and perhaps psychically afterwards, we can replenish our ability to help and heal others. This is true of those engaged in ritual healing, but also for those engaged in assisting the damaged and broken among us to find greater wholeness in every field of endeavor. It is just as true for psychologists, social workers, physicians, and nurses, for counselors and teachers, indeed for anyone occupied with working to help heal the world. First, we work to heal. Then we must work to heal ourselves so that we can continue to help others. When we return in a moment here on Two Jewish, our guest, sociology professor Sarah Benor, will explore the implications of the Pew Report, how newly Orthodox Jews figure out how to fit in, and explore how Jewish camps teach Hebrew, among many other diverse and interesting subjects, all when we come back in a few moments on Two Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun. They're out Enterprise of the Pasquagaki Tribe.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from our guest, Rabbi Sandy Seltzer.
Israel's foreign ministry has just issued a 280-page study declaring that during last summer's Gaza war with Hamas, Israeli troops abided by the principles of international law regarding the killing of innocent civilians to the extent that their own soldiers were often put at unnecessary risk. The report contends that most of the civilian casualties were a result of a Hamas deliberately storing ammunition and placing weapons and rocket launchers in mosques, hospitals, schools, and residential neighborhoods. The study, along with a second drafted by five retired generals from other countries with similar conclusions, are intended to counter findings published by the United Nations, which Israel has condemned as one-sided and biased. For several weeks, a controversy has raged in Israel over whether a motion picture documentary about the life of Yigal Amir, the man who assassinated Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin 20 years ago, should be part of the Jerusalem International Film Festival, which is partially funded by the City of Jerusalem. Entitled Beyond the Fear, the film has been accused of being overly sentimental regarding Amir, who was serving a life sentence for the killing. At first, a spokesman for the city defended showing the film as part of its policy of not censoring controversial movies. In response, Rabin's granddaughter is quoted as saying, "Anyone who holds democracy dear should be afraid of this. It is a cynical use of freedom of speech." After much debate, the film will not be shown. In an effort to make amends for the expulsion in the year 1492 of members of one of the most important Jewish communities in Jewish history, Spain has offered Jews of Sephardic descent living anywhere in the world an opportunity to become Spanish citizens once more. The law of return, as it is known, will become effective in October and be valid for 3 years, after which it can be renewed. Those wishing to do so must have a Spanish notary and pass a series of tests regarding the Spanish language and Spanish history. It will also be necessary for the applicant to be approved by the Federation of Jewish Centers of Spain. In his praise of Spain's actions, the center's president stated, "Today we write a page of reunion and hope that enriches us as a people and which makes Spanish Jews feel proud to be behind the door that our country is opening." Here in this country, two recent surveys show a marked difference between the attitudes of Jews and those of persons who are not Jewish about the popularity of President Obama and approval of his policies. In one, undertaken by J Street, the center-left pro-Israel organization, 56% of Jews were supportive of the president in comparison to 46% of non-Jews. And in a CNN poll, when asked if they were in favor of the Obama administration's efforts to reach a nuclear agreement with Iran, while 53% of persons who were not Jewish said yes, 59% of Jews did so. On a lighter note, currently Jews have figured prominently in the world of sports. In horse racing, the first Triple Crown winner in over a decade, American Pharaoh, is owned by Egyptian-born Ahmad Zayat, an observant Orthodox Jew, who along with members of his family walked to the racetrack, since all three races were held on the Sabbath. And in professional basketball, the Cleveland Cavaliers, a team which fought valiantly before losing in the championship finals, was led by its Jewish coach, David Blatt, who before coming to the NBA coached winning teams in Europe and in Israel. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Sarah Benur is at Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in Los Angeles, where she's an associate professor and works in a variety of areas having to do with American Jewish sociology and anthropology. She wrote the award-winning book Becoming From, How Newcomers Learn the Language and Culture of Orthodox Judaism, just a few years ago. She's written a number of articles in Jewish studies and linguistics and has studied a number of sort of contemporary aspects of Jewish life, not in the way that we rabbis do, which is we look at it and we draw conclusions, but in what might be called a systematic and academic way. Can you explain the difference?
Okay, well, I think some rabbis might say that they do systematic analysis, but...
Okay, now look, I know a lot of rabbis, and what we think of as systematic analysis is not quite the same as what a sociologist does.
Systematic textual analysis.
That's true.
There you go. So my research generally involves ethnography, which means systematic hanging out with people and getting to know them and interviewing them informally, and then also interviewing them formally, and sometimes I've also used surveys. And so all of these methods help me to better understand American Jews and language.
When you look at the American Jewish community, you know, it's a huge, diverse place, the largest or the second largest Jewish community in the world, depending on how you count, and certainly spread out over a lot more area than Israel is. Would the objection be that any study you do is bound to be somewhat anecdotal?
Yes, that is true. And even the quantitative study that I did of American Jewish language and identity, where Stephen Cohen and I wrote a survey and we sent it out to 600 people, and it went viral, and we got over 40,000 responses from Jews and non-Jews around the country.
Wow.
Even that is somewhat anecdotal in that it's not a random sample of American Jews. So even though we have such high numbers, and we do have people from every state and people from all different denominations and orientations, it still is not a random sample of American Jews. And it's very expensive to get that kind of random sample. The Pew study and the National Jewish Population study were millions and millions of dollars to hire people to do all those phone calls. In the absence of several million dollars to do that kind of research.
That's a big grant.
Yeah, exactly. We have to do other kinds of research. And also, doing a survey will get you certain kinds of information, but doing interviews will get you different information, more in-depth information about the how and the why, and not just the who and the what and the how many.
You mentioned the Pew study, and of course the Pew study came up with findings that were quite different in some areas than the National Jewish Population Survey that had been done 10 years before, maybe a little more than 10 years before. You have some kind of interesting observations about it. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. My understanding is that a lot of people were very upset when the Pew study came out, that they said, this is horrible, the sky is falling, or...
Imagine that, Jews being, like, worried about things. How could that possibly be true?
Even though I'm Jewish, I'm not worried about it, and I'll tell you why. Because I look at this in the context of American ethnic groups and American religious groups more generally. And in comparison to other ethnic and religious groups, Jews are actually doing really well in terms of maintaining their identity and continuing to be a part of the community. Extremely high numbers of Jews say that they're proud to be Jewish, which you wouldn't have gotten 50 years ago. The numbers would have been much lower if they had asked that particular question. And people are still identifying as Jewish in large numbers. Not everyone, because certainly there are people who are raised by one Jewish parent with very little Jewish education who don't consider themselves Jewish. But a large percentage do, and that's heartening. And I think the reason for that is because of our Jewish organizations. The Jewish community it has so many organizations, not just our synagogues and our schools, but our philanthropic organizations, our political organizations, our social service organizations. This whole infrastructure is the object of envy of communities, of other American communities. They look to the Jews as a model for how to maintain a community and serve a community really well.
You know, I was thinking, and you could extend that, the Jewish museums, Jewish institutes for memorializing the Holocaust, Jewish musical groups, you know, there's just such a plethora.
Jewish radio shows.
Exactly. Which are hopefully not, you know, too Jewish. The Pew study, I also wasn't worried, although it seemed to me that it shows that Jews are prouder and prouder and know and do less and less than before. Yeah, I think so. But that's not also so terrible in some ways. But I do remember the last Jewish population study showed that Jews were declining and we had less than 5 million Jews, perhaps. And then the Pew study seems to show quite the opposite, that we continue to grow at a slow, smallish rate.
I love how the Pew study has an interactive tool on its website that you can check boxes for who you consider to be Jewish. Are the children of people who are Jewish but not by religion, Jewish even if they don't consider themselves Jewish? If you say yes, then you check that box and you add up all the boxes you check and you get how many Jews there are in the country based on your understanding of who is a Jew.
So if a famous Jewish philanthropist decided to give you untold millions to redo the Pew study, what would you do differently?
Oh, I don't think I would do anything differently. In fact, I was on the advisory panel of the study, and so I was in on the conversations. And the problem is you have to make these decisions throughout the process of doing the study. But the Pew study did a better job than the last National Jewish Population Study in that they asked the questions of everybody. The NJPS didn't ask certain questions of people who didn't meet certain requirements of being Jewish. And so you can't really compare the data so well between those two studies. But I actually think they did a really good job. If I got to add in more questions, I would ask more questions about language, because I'm really curious whether Jews know certain Hebrew and Yiddish words. The survey that I did with Stephen Cohen about American Jewish language and identity asked not only about certain Hebrew and Yiddish words that people use, but also things like, have people told you that you interrupt too much? Because that's a stereotypical feature of New York Jewish speech. Or,
I'm sorry, I have to interrupt you here.
Go ahead.
Sorry, no, I really don't. I just wanted to say that. Go ahead.
Well, you were just overlapping. You weren't interrupting.
Okay.
So that's, I would ask questions about language and identity, and then I would see how those kinds of linguistic features correlate with denomination and Jewish education.
One of the really unexpected phenomena of my lifetime has been the rise of the sort of neo-frum, the dynamism of Chabad, the growth of Baal Tshuva movements, a number of different programs that have brought young Jews into Orthodoxy. You've studied this. Talk a little bit about how people who are raised secular, some of them not even raised Jewish, end up becoming part of this apparently burgeoning culture.
Yeah, so in my book, Becoming Frum, I don't focus so much on why they become Orthodox. I focus on the process of becoming Orthodox. So when people, sometimes they're interested in the community by learning about it from a friend or by attending a class at an outreach center. And once they get involved, they often get hooked based on their visits to communities where there are very large, very tight-knit families and communities where everyone helps each other, and that's really attractive to a lot of young people and older people too. And so the process of becoming Orthodox is not just a religious one, it's also a cultural one. As people are integrated into Orthodox communities, they learn the laws, they learn how to observe Shabbos, but they also learn the language and the dress and the foods. Not only which foods you're allowed to eat with which in terms of kashrut, but also how to eat Eastern European foods and how to make a kugel for 20 people, that kind of thing. And in the language, they learn not only the Hebrew and Aramaic words that are in our traditional texts, but they also learn Yiddish grammatical constructions like staying by them, or what do we learn out from this? And they learn distinctive intonation. If you've heard it, you know what I'm talking about.
Right. You know, it's fascinating because these are often people with very different backgrounds. I remember, by the way, it's not just in America. I remember being at a Shabbat in Sfat, Israel, and it was through a Chabad program as it happened. And the people we were staying with, one was from Florence, Italy, and the other was from Tunisia, and yet they were speaking Yiddish.
Right. It's really amazing how Chabad in particular, but also other types of Haredi Orthodoxy have made their way around the world. And so you get people from Sephardi, Mizrahi backgrounds who look to Chabad and Eish HaTorah as the role models of Orthodoxy. And so sometime, actually there was a study of a group in Argentina where the Mizrahi Jews were making brisket and kugel and not interested anymore in their grandparents' cooking, and they were also starting to pronounce the Zmirot as Zmiris instead of the way they learned it.
It's fascinating. It's sort of an, you know, it seems strange, but you can't really predict these things. You can just describe them. One of the great concerns that people have consistently today in the Jewish world is about how we integrate younger Jews. And you've studied this as well to a degree.
Yes, I did a study of young Jewish leaders in Los Angeles, people in their 20s and 30s who are involved as professionals or volunteer leaders in Jewish organizations. And there really are a lot of young people who are involved and interested. And what I found was that they're interested in two different spheres in the community. So people talk about the establishment and the non-establishment or startup spheres of the Jewish community. So organizations that have been around for many decades, like the Federation and American Jewish Committee, and philanthropic organizations, even some newer ones like Friends of the IDF and Stand With Us, would attract a certain crowd. And then newer organizations, especially in the social justice and cultural spheres, would attract a slightly different crowd. And so I think it's really important for the Jewish community to continue to have organizations like those in those different spheres that attract different types of people, and also to really empower young people to get involved. Because if they just go to events and they don't have much say in what happens, then that's not going to work so well. It works best if the events come from the young people themselves.
So a final question, speaking as a congregational rabbi, what kinds of things should synagogues be doing, or do you think the sociology directs to attract younger Jews?
Synagogues in particular?
Synagogues in particular.
Interestingly, a lot of young people don't go to synagogue or to church until they have children, or sometimes until they get married.
And that's been true for a while, of course.
Yeah, something that churches talk about too. Why are all of our young people not coming anymore? The answer is because of the delayed age of marriage, because people are getting married and having children at a later age. And so I don't know if it's necessary for synagogues in particular to try to reach that population of young adults. I think other organizations might be better equipped to do that. And Hillel's have done a great job on college campuses, and there are a number of organizations that are attracting young adults. Birthright in particular is doing a good job of getting young adults engaged through the Israel trips, and then other organizations are picking up after the trips. One of my students wrote a really interesting master's thesis about birthright-surrounded engagement, that is, engaging people starting from before the trip, during the trip, and after the trip. And there's a whole industry now of people who are trying to engage young adults, especially surrounding birthright.
I want to thank Professor Sarah Benor for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about your work?
Well, the Hebrew Union College website, and also jewishlanguages.org, where they can find the Jewish English lexicon.
I could use that, I think, from time to time. Thanks again for a great visit.
Thank you so much.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Ian Sieb, medical marijuana entrepreneur and Jewish community activist. Our playout this morning is a newish classic song about peace, very popular at Jewish camps, Od Yavo Shalom Aleinu, sung well by Andy Suzuki. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
Od Yavo Shalom Aleinu. Od Yavo Shalom Aleinu. Od Yavo Shalom Aleinu. Ve'al Kulam. Od Yavo Shalom Aleinu. Od Yavo Shalom Aleinu.